Welcome back to Technically Economics. I'm Dominic.
I'm Cassidy.
And we are two econ PhD students at Harvard coming to you from the Cambridge Public Library. Cassidy, can you remind us the premise of the show?
Sure can. On each episode of this podcast, either Dominic or I will bring a topic of discussion and try to convince the other and you, the listener, that that topic technically counts as economics.
Yes, and you can follow us on Instagram at Technically Economics. This is going to be important, again, because you can vote on who is better at convincing the other and the listener at that something is economics. And so we're going to continue to do polls. We've been doing polls. Thank you to all who voted. And we also share a lot of reels and other content there. So great place. Follow us if you haven't. We also have a very exciting update.
Yes. So, as you know, we are a Cambridge, Massachusetts-based podcast. Cambridge, Massachusetts, famously neighbor of Somerville, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And starting later this month, there is a Somerville community radio project we are going to be participating in called Nightcap Cafe.
Ooh.
So Nightcap is going to be hosting a bunch of local artists, creators, students.
Nice.
Come on, chat about what they do.
Nice.
On Somerville Public Radio. So you'll be able to catch us on the Somerville airwaves.
Whoa.
Next month, December 11th.
Whoa.
From 9 to 9:30 p.m.
Okay.
So for more information on that, you can find Nightcap Cafe on Instagram. We'll have another episode before then, so we'll give you a little bit more details when it's a bit closer, but just want to put that on your radar.
Yeah, mark your calendars. What was it, December 11th?
December 11th.
9 to 9:30.
9 to 9:30 p.m.
But yeah, mark your calendar. It's going to be good. I have a presentation the next day for the PhD, so if nothing else, listen to me before I go do a poor presentation. okay, moving on to the business of the day.
The business of the day. Let's get into it.
Today,
yes.
I'm going to try to convince you, Cassidy,
yes,
that dating apps are technically economics.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Online dating.
Dating apps.
I'm very excited for this one. I think it's going to be a very fun time. I think it's going to be a fun topic to talk about. I do want to say at the outset, it's going to be a little interesting for me to present this because I am old and have been in a relationship for a long time, so I have not actually used a dating app for myself personally. I'm in an analog marriage.
Analog marriage.
But you have used a dating app.
I have used dating apps, yes.
Yeah. You want to talk a little bit about your experiences on dating apps?
Sure. Well, I met my fiance on a dating app.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah. I didn't know. I think I knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. So my fiance and I met on Tinder.
Back when Tinder was for that.
Well, so we met during the pandemic. And I think that Tinder had a brief vibe shift during early pandemic when,
yeah.
I don't know.
Other ways.
Hookup culture was struggling
under early
pandemic. And then I think people were ready to bunker down for the long term on all kinds of dating apps.
Yeah.
So I had one very good experience on Tinder. And no other notable experiences at all.
Nice. Did you have I guess maybe not if it was short-lived, did you have like a go-to line?
Well, I don't think I had like a go-to. The one that I did that worked on my fiance, and it was a line I started doing one person before him.
Nice.
The one person before him gave me nothing.
Oh, no.
And then I matched with Scott, and I said, if you thought that your house was haunted, like how direct would the signs need to be for you to literally make the decision to sell a house and move? Like, how concrete do you think the haunting
would
need
to be? That's a great, like, I feel like that's great because it is funny, and if you don't think it's funny, that's a good sign that, like, yeah.
Yeah, you're probably not really going to like me that much.
What, do you know what his answer was to that?
I don't really remember what his answer was. I remember, though, that I thought it would be a good line to use on him because his profile, which was pretty sparse, his bio just said he was in a master's program for to become a teacher at the time.
Yeah.
And his bio was future teacher, future ghost.
I thought
that was cute.
Nice. Yeah. So that is very fitting then. Nice. Wow, that's a very I didn't know that story. That's a very cute story.
Mm-hmm. Very cute.
So you are in the majority. Over half of adults 30 or under have used a dating app.
Yes.
And that includes many of my friends and family. I've done a little swiping and setting up profiles for others, so I have some idea of what goes on these apps.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if, in addition to your own stories, if you have any like good or bad or weird dating app stories from any friends or family.
Yeah, I have kind of an insane one that I fear may be too long for the pod, but okay. I'm simply going to tell
you.
Yeah,
we can always cut it down. Yeah, you guys are going to hear the abridged version starting now. Yeah.
So this is like one of my childhood best friends and like best friends to this day.
Yeah.
The first time that she had ever used a dating app, she was like, you know, kind of out with her friends drinking and like matched that night, starts talking to this guy, and he like asked her to go on a date the next day. And her, she'd okay. never done it before, but her
yeah.
friends were like, he seems cute. This is fun. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Do it.
I have been the friends at the bar, I feel like, in this,
Yes. So she decides to do it. So he pulls up to her apartment in the afternoon to pick her up for this date. He is standing with a bouquet of flowers in front of a white van.
Okay.
And as he pulls up to pick her up, at the same time, a bunch of her friends are having like a darty where they are walking down the street in a mob. So they are walking by as this man pulls up to pick her up with flowers.
Okay.
And they're like cheering. They're like, kiss him. And she's just like, oh man, this is a lot. He like takes her around to the back of the car and like opens up the door for her to get in. And Dominic, it is a van with no seats. It is an entirely empty vehicle.
Yeah,
with
I don't
just
like this.
A driver's seat.
I don't like
and
this
a
at
bench
all.
In the back.
Okay. Can she sit in the is there a passenger seat?
No,
there's
nothing.
I don't like this.
There's nothing.
I don't like this at all.
And like this group had just been watching and cheering. The cheering
Yep.
is done.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no more.
Yeah.
But my friend
she does get in the van?
She gets in the van, yeah.
Okay, all right.
I mean, she gets in the van. She goes on this date. It's, like, not a great date.
Okay.
But it's not, it's not like,
not
scary.
Kidnapped. Okay, yeah.
It's just weird.
Okay.
And he's pretty weird.
Okay, all right.
But I haven't told you the crazy part yet.
Oh, no, okay.
He sends her a letter. I'm just going to show you this for length. He sends
okay.
it digitally, but it is like a Word document
yeah.
that he sends her.
That is a little bit serial killer vibes.
It's
yeah.
long. I'm just going to read the first couple of sentences and then maybe the last couple.
Okay.
I am aware that we have only for the first time met today, October 27th, 2018.
It's a little redundant.
However, I find it hard to draw to mind the words that I truly wish to speak, for I fear judgment and I fear segregation.
This is pre ChatGPT. He came up with those words all on his own. Yeah.
He came up with this all himself. But howsoever my mind may be flawed, I fear not writing you. I am pleased to express my gratitude through literature, for you have given me one more reason to write.
Oh, that's kind of sweet.
Oh, Dominic, no, it isn't. And then he says a lot of other stuff. You've left an enduring impression on my life, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
My only hope is that just as you have for me, I have left some impression on your soul. For all
soul.
One knows, I may establish myself as a mere scribble, an inkling in the book which you call your life.
That's
I wish not to bore you. Thus, I will soon put to bed my thoughts.
Wow. That's a tale.
Yeah, it is. And he has an insane name, which I obviously won't say on the podcast, but I'm just going to tell you and I'm going to bleep it out.
Oh, nice. So yeah. Okay.
His name is.
I don't want to like react too much for fear of revealing the name, but unbelievable. To get to the economics.
Oh yeah, economics.
Yeah.
I forgot.
Well, we're really earning the technically in the name. today. I think there's a bunch of different ways we could take this, and I'm a little worried about this, like the pre versus post poll, because I think like people maybe already have a lot of like this is pretty economics-y in their head. Especially dedicated listeners of the show maybe will remember our Love Island episode, where you talked a lot about matching problems and how it relates to different dating problems and finding a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
So dedicated listeners might see the pre-poll, put it together, and yeah, that could be bad. That could be bad for me.
God willing.
I'm not gonna talk about matching problems this episode, which I think is sort of maybe the most obvious connection to dating apps. And instead, I want to talk about a few different core economic concepts that I think are also at the core of dating apps.
Okay.
And to start, I'm going to ask you a question that isn't immediately about dating apps, but will help us come back to it. And I'm going to ask you, you know, say it's a Friday night. You're trying to chill at home, watch a movie, maybe open your computer, you do some searching, you're watching trailers for movies, time's going by, it's getting a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
You see one you sort of like, and you ask yourself at this moment, okay, is this the one I'm going to watch, or am I going to watch another trailer, keep going? What are the sort of trade-offs you might be thinking about at that moment?
Yes. So this is a problem I, like, viscerally hate. Like, one of my least favorite things is being in a room full of people and spending, like, 30 to 40 minutes scrolling to decide what to watch.
Yeah.
But so I guess the problem you kind of have at any given moment is, like, do we just watch the front runner we have right now, or is there maybe something still out there that's a better mood for tonight?
So
there's obviously some cost to keep searching, and that like you have to spend more time if you're going to watch more trailers. And if you're me, you're always like calculating how many minutes do I have before I need to go to bed, like how long of a movie does that allow me to watch, and what are the set of movies. So actually the longer you spend searching, the set of movies even available to you is shrinking. You can't watch certain movies anymore if they're too long. But on the other hand, like sometimes the front runner movie is just like not that great of a movie. I always know at any given time there is some movie that I would like to watch. Like, I believe it exists. It's just a question of, am I going to find it by looking for, you know, 5 more minutes?
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is a classic trade off between the cost of continuing to search. You have to watch another trailer. The night is slipping away. Bedtime's getting closer. And the benefits of continuing to search because you might find a better movie. So classic trade off. Now, let's think about a slightly different context.
Okay.
You have a friend named Fred.
Fred.
Yeah.
Got it.
He's been on the dating apps a bit, and he's gone on a couple of dates with a couple of different girls. Now he's gone on a couple with this particular girl. And sorry, I realize we're going to be very heteronormative probably this entire podcast. So.
Okay, well, that's on you, not me.
Fair enough, I guess. We could have Fred searching for a boyfriend. Why not?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And he's trying to decide whether to be exclusive with this particular partner of any gender, I guess. I don't know. Do you think that sort of a similar trade-off applies? I mean, definitely more complicated, but what sorts of things might you consider in this situation?
Yeah, obviously, like, it sounds a little weird to talk about dating in this way.
Yeah.
But, like,
I started with the movie example for a reason.
But, yeah, I think totally when you're dating, and, like, most people in serious relationships have some point where they think, like, if you are going to make a decision, I guess, particularly, like, if your goal is ultimately, like, a monogamous relationship, I would say I don't know a lot about the goals of non-monogamous relationships, so I'm not going to address that.
We are being inclusive in this. I don't know.
But you're married. I'm getting married. What we know about is
Yeah.
So, like, if your goal is, like, finding the person who you want to, you know, hopefully spend the rest of your life with, then, like, at some points in the relationship, you kind of, like, need to be doing an evaluation of, like, is this my person? And maybe this is, like, a controversial take, but I think that for, like, most people, when they think about that and their answer is affirmative, that doesn't necessarily mean like, I don't believe there's possibly anyone else in the world who I could have as beautiful of a relationship as I have with my person. But I think like you have, you know, a sufficiently beautiful relationship.
With this is getting deep, I feel like, in on Tech Act today.
But there's
it's
always
like, is true love a real thing? is soulmates? Cassidy, please answer.
But it's always there's like a trade-off between like, I mean, and I think people talk a lot about like being afraid of commitment. How is that not the same problem as like searching for a movie? It's like, you know that there are like other possibilities out there. You can't know, you know, kind of how you can't know that you're at the optimum or something until you've done lots of searching.
Yeah.
But then at some level, like making the best choice for you certainly is not searching indefinitely.
Making
the best choice for you is like knowing when to be happy. And
I think that's right, and people do use this sort of logic, like econ people, but others do use some version of this logic all the time. You know, you want to know things, you know, about sort of your preferences, how long you've been searching, how big the pool of potential candidates is, but then you can sort of think of it like what I will call an optimal stopping problem.
Optimal stopping problem.
And just to emphasize how core economics that are, do you remember our first year macroeconomics course?
I do remember covering optimal stopping in first year macro. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a core tenet of grad school economics. We did a very fun dynamic programming version of it. But there are lots of different versions of it. And these sorts of problems appear everywhere. Yeah, like, you know, we talked about the movie decision. You can think about, you know, deciding between TV shows. You can also think about, like, bigger life decisions, like when to stop looking for the perfect house, or, you know, how to look for houses, when to look for the right job candidate, when to stop searching for a paper if you're an econ PhD student. It's a dark one for all of the econ PhD students out there.
When to quit your job and pursue a career as a podcaster.
Yeah, exactly. But one application of optimal stopping problems is dating partners. And so with our friend Fred, there were a lot of different parameters, you could imagine, of the problem, a lot of different things going on. But there's a very famous version of this problem, of an optimal stopping problem, which makes a number of simplifications, but really helps things out. And then it has this really elegant solution. It's called the secretary problem, inspired by the idea that you're picking a secretary to hire. So you have to like hire a bunch of secretaries. You're hiring, gonna hire one. But I'm gonna use the language a little bit more of dating apps because I think it applies there.
There's something that feels weird about using a
secretary
analogy for a dating. and I feel like maybe it's like not an accident that it was called the secretary
problem.
And also clearly applies to looking for a...
This is like, I think it was like mathematicians in like the 60s and 70s naming these things. So that seems like a potentially problematic bunch. Okay, so the idea is this. Here's the sort of simplifications. You're looking for one, and I'm going to talk about it in dating terms. You're looking for one partner.
Yeah.
You know there's a pool of N potential partners, but you don't know how big N is. N is a number. If you've had one date with everyone, you could clearly rank them from best to worst. Like there is like a, you have those sorts of preferences.
Yep.
But instead, you date them one at a time in a random order. And the key thing is after each date, you have to either say, okay, this is the person I want to keep dating, I want to become exclusive with, or reject them. And that's a final decision, and you can't go back. Like, once you've gone on a date and said nope, then you can't go back and go to someone again.
Yep, too awkward.
Too awkward. Yeah, it seems realistic, actually. Yeah,
yeah.
In that sense.
That's one of the more realistic assumptions about social interactions that mathematicians have made.
You can only base your decision on how this person compares to the ones you've already seen. There's no, like, universal ranking or anything like that.
Yep.
And your goal is to maximize your chance of picking the best of the bunch.
And so, like, you sort of don't know anything about the distribution
except for,
like, what you have observed from previous people you've
met. Yeah, which is, like, kind of a, if we're talking about, like, the math, like, it's kind of a sort of beautiful result that this works without, like, oh, people are drawn from a particular distribution. No, it doesn't matter what the distribution is. Can be any distribution, as long as they are truly coming in random order.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so lots of simplifying assumptions there. We can quibble with some of them in a second. But what I think makes this setup sort of lasting and appealing is that it has a very elegant solution. You go on 1 over e dates, where e is the natural log. This is around 37%. So 1 over e of the n over e, I guess, total. So you go on dates with 37% of the entire pool.
Okay.
And then after that, and you say no to all of them. You know going into those dates, I'm not going to say yes to any of these people. And after you get to the 37th percent whatever, you say, okay, if I find anyone now that was better than anyone in the first 37%, I stop and I pick them immediately. And you just keep doing that. And that is if your goal is to maximize the chance of picking the very best partner out of the whole group, that is the correct solution.
Oh, because if you get to the end, then I see.
Yeah, you can't go backwards is the key thing.
Yeah, because you can't go backwards.
Yeah, yeah. Because if you could go backwards, you could just go on a date with everyone and then pick the best one.
Right.
But here, you can't go backwards.
Got it. Got it.
What do you think about this advice as it applies to actual dating?
I think both there's like some truth in it, and I think it's sort of maybe good to like philosophically hold in mind. But I also kind of think that it's hard to I guess in order to do this, you need to be able to say like, I am going to like experience this relationship, learn how I feel about it, but with, you know, complete commitment, I'm going to say no, this is not the relationship
for
me. And I think that there are some people who would like benefit from this advice of just being like, you just need to date people to date people, and like you need to. But I also think that like part of how you learn about whether a relationship works for you for a long-term thing is by like seriously
trying.
Emotionally considering
yeah.
the possibility.
Yeah.
And so like it's a little hard for you to imagine how you could in practice like learn the emotional truths you need to learn while also knowing that you're not going to commit to the relationship.
Yeah, yeah. It is like kind of a crazy thing if you take it very literally. Like literally what it says is like, okay, I want to go on no more than 10 dates total. There's like 10 dates or 10 people I want to date total. So I'm going to go on 3. And like those first 3, I'm just going to go and be like, all right, I'm just here to learn my preferences.
Yeah.
It's like kind of a crazy thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like I think I do think there is, like you were saying, like some, like, maybe if you don't take it super literally, but you take it sort of seriously, I think there is some truth to it where it's like,
totally.
You want to go in the first few and sort of just like think about where you're at and like how it's going and sort of as a benchmark. And then you can sort of, because, and then it also has good guidance where it's like, then once you've done that for a bit, if you find something that's better, just like stop. Like, I know people who are the reverse too, where it's just like, you know, I'm going to try to find the perfect. It's like, this is better than anything you've done at this point. Like, it's probably fine. Getting back to the deep philosophical Cassidy point is like, there are no soulmates, maybe. I don't know. Or maybe there are. I don't know.
Do you feel that you dated 37% possible dating pool before committing to your wife?
I did not follow that rule. And my marriage is very happy, I think.
Sure seems
you can
that
ask
way.
Liz, yeah. Happy from my perspective.
Liz seems happy.
Okay.
It is kind of funny thinking about, like, if you had to write down, like, what is your dating pool? And, like, what would 37% of your dating pool even be? Because I think that would be tractable, like, 50 years ago when, people are dating someone from their high school and you're kind of going out with people. And, like, the full set is, like, 15 to 20 people.
Yeah.
And then it's, like, now, okay, if you're a young single person living in a city, it's, like, in principle, you could say that the dating pool is like, you know, 10,000 people.
Yeah.
And probably
you
no one should optimally date 3,700 people before committing.
So that is, there is like obviously a ton of more complicated versions of this problem. The one that we had to do in, which was not a matching problem, the one we had to do in first year grad school, like a key thing was there was a cost every time you had to search. And so you could imagine like it cost time and money to go on a date. And so that's going to sort of complicate this thing as well.
Right. But it was cool here that like you don't necessarily need a notion of cost to have to get this kind of result that you should, to learn about where you should stop. You just need that you can't go backwards.
The other thing that I think is like when I was thinking about it earlier today, a little weird with just the goal of this problem. So it is the goal of the problem, as it is said, is to maximize the probability of finding the best person in the pool. But you're actually creating a lot of possibilities that you end up with someone. Like, you're not maximizing, like, the expected value or something like that.
Yeah.
Because if you search through 37% of people and you're going to say no to them no matter what, then there's a 37% chance that, like, the best person was in that pool.
Yeah.
And there's no chance that you will get them. And what happens in that situation is, like, the algorithm just has you keep going until you get to the end, and then you just say yes to the last person. So it's literally just a random draw of how good the last person is, like, a third of the time.
Yeah, so that's true. Interesting.
Yeah, so maybe a reason not to follow this advice. Yeah. And it is sort of the proof is, you know, online in a bunch of different ways. It's a very short proof. It's kind of, it's very pretty. I don't know. So I think that's why that problem has so much staying power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's angle one.
All right. Secretary problem.
Secretary problem. Using optimal stopping problems to find the right time to stop on online dating apps. Angle two. I want to talk next about inequality.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, serious stuff on the pod today. Okay.
This is the idea that some people get more of something or are way better off than others.
Mm-hmm.
And Cassie, this was not an angle that I was thinking of when I picked this topic originally. But this week I was talking to different people about this idea, trying to collect ideas. And this is one that a few different people had mentioned being very interested in. That was not at all on my radar. And it's the idea that dating apps are cesspools of inequality.
Oh, no. What does that mean?
So I think we'll be very precise
okay.
in what we mean about that. But we're going to have to build up to it.
Okay.
As good economists or economists in training.
Always have to build up to everything. Can't you just shoot from the hip?
Shoot from the hip. I feel like this whole podcast is a little bit shooting from.
We have to build up to shooting from the hip.
Yeah, exactly. It's not gonna be very precise. Okay. To talk about inequality, I think in dating apps or anywhere else, I think we need to be able to measure it. So, Cassie, I want to ask you to maybe explain why quantifying inequality is maybe not so straightforward, or how there's like sort of different ways that we could think about quantifying inequality and the sort of challenges or things we might want out of a measure of inequality.
Okay. So maybe it's like easiest to talk about this or most familiar talking about this with something like wealth or income inequality.
Yeah.
And I think we all have kind of like a intuitive notion of sort of what we generally mean when we talk about income inequality, but I think it's a hard thing to be precise about. And so let me give a couple of examples I'm thinking of. So
okay.
One is like, do you care about inequality on some kind of outcomes, or do you care about like inequality in terms of like some notion of opportunity? Do we care if there's a lot of inequality, if there's a lot of like upward mobility
or something like that?
You might say like, well, if we live in a society where like from birth anyone could kind of have opportunities and could get anything they wanted, then maybe we wouldn't care as much if we had a lot of inequality up for debate. Different people would say different things. But even if we just said, okay, what we really care about is income inequality, then like you can imagine kind of pretty different notions of an unequal income distribution. So you could imagine like you have like some very, very wealthy people on the top and then everything else is like pretty flat. Like either you're super, super rich or you're not super rich, and everyone who's not super rich is sort of on the same boat.
Yeah.
You could also imagine like slightly like less extreme at the top, but also like more extreme at the bottom. Like you have just like a very, very poor group on the lowest end of the income distribution. And then if you wanted to say like which one of those societies is more unequal, I don't know.
Tough.
It depends.
Yeah.
And there are different things you could calculate.
Yeah, exactly. You can imagine a measure like, you know, 1% of the people have 20% of the wealth. That's one way to do it. You could also do 10% of the people have 40% of the wealth, or the bottom 10% of the people have only 1% of the wealth. Like there's like,
yeah.
And so there's sort of a lot of different related ways that you can talk about inequality.
Yep.
There is one particular measure that we end up using a lot in economics because it tries to capture this whole distribution. And so I want to talk a little bit about that measure. And we're going to come back to dating apps eventually in this
okay.
measure. We're going to get back to non-income inequality. We're going to talk about it in the context of income inequality, as you were talking about, because I think that builds a lot of like simple intuition. Yeah. And so the measure is called the Gini coefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Do you happen to remember anything about the Gini coefficient maybe from like undergrad econ or anything?
So I don't exactly remember how it is calculated, but
yeah.
what I do remember is that there's some connection to the University of Iowa, my
yeah, yeah.
alma mater, I believe. So it's like related to the Lorenz curve or something. And
yeah.
the guy who wrote the Lorenz curve, I think his name is Lorenz.
Yeah.
He came up with this when he was an undergraduate student at Iowa. It was his undergraduate student
wow.
thesis. And
wow,
like
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Is that is true?
That's true.
Wow.
I checked myself on Wikipedia to
okay.
make sure.
yeah, yeah.
And Wikipedia says that this is
wow.
right, like a very commonly used concept in
yeah.
economics.
Yeah.
Just an undergrad thesis. Pretty
wow.
cool.
This is also public universities. We're crushing it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
This is, like,
and
the
it's
second...
old too. It's like 1912 or early 1900s.
Wow. Wow.
But
okay.
I don't remember what exactly the Gini coefficient
yeah, okay, okay.
is, so maybe
so,
you
yeah,
can
we will,
remind
we're
me.
We're going to walk through it. So the idea is pretty simple, but I think there's like a moving part, so I'll try to walk through it slowly, and again, I'm going to do it in terms of income inequality.
Okay.
You can imagine a line, and on the far left side of that line, you put like the poorest person in a particular country, and then you just line everyone up in that in the country from left to right, and so by income, and so the far right side of the line, you have the richest person in the country. So you got like whatever, Elon Musk, Larry Ellison over there on the right. You got the poorest people on the left. Everyone else is somewhere in the middle, all lined up by income. Okay, that's you can think of that as the x-axis of a graph, if you
okay.
will. Then you can draw another line on top that shows the total income of everyone up until that point.
Okay.
And so this line is, as you were alluding to a little bit in your answer before, this line would start pretty flat because the lowest income people make up a relatively small portion of the full income. And then as you get to the highest income people, this line would get much steeper. So you can sort of imagine this curve, the Lorenz curve. that goes upward because at the end you'd have like Larry Ellison and his, I mean, I guess this is in wealth, but his income would be like, you know, he's only 1/300 millionth of the U.S. population, but he makes up like, I don't know, 0.5% of income or something like that. And so the way that the Gini coefficient works is you just take that curve, that sort of bent curve,
yep.
and you compare it to a 45 degree line.
Okay. Can you talk through the intuition of what
yep.
the 45-degree
yep.
line is?
Yeah, so the 45-degree line is if everyone in the U.S. had the same income and we did the same exercise, then we'd line everyone up, they'd all have the same income, and then we'd draw that same line, and there'd be no bend in it. It would be a 45-degree line.
Just be a 45-degree
because
line.
Because each, if like one, any 1% of the people will have exactly 1% of the income because everyone has the same income.
Okay, okay.
And so in a world in which there is perfect equality of outcomes, in whatever outcome, again, we're talking about income, but we're going to say you can do this in any outcome, you'd have this 45 degree line.
Yeah. We should put we'll put a picture of a Lorenz curve on the Instagram for you.
Nice. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Maybe this diagram.
So you can visualize.
Yeah, yeah. The way then we actually go from this 45 degree line and this bent curve to the Gini coefficient is we just say, okay, what is the difference between those two curves?
Okay.
The way that we take the difference is we look at the area between the two, and we compare that to the area that you would get if there was perfect inequality. And that would be like everyone makes no money.
Mm.
Larry Ellison makes all of the money. Then you would just get like this like right angle,
yep.
if that makes sense.
Yep.
And so if none of that made sense, the simple intuition is then a Gini coefficient of 0 is going to be a situation in which everyone has the same income. A Gini coefficient of 1 is everyone except one person makes $0. The other person makes all of the money. And then the extent to which you're closer to one than zero is inequality. So bigger measures of the Gini coefficient, measures closer to one, are more inequality. And it's sort of a beautiful measure because, as you were alluding to earlier, you have like, you could have inequality at different parts of the distribution. This is like a full distribution measure of inequality. So you can compare across countries. We can do it in income. We can do it in wealth. We can do it in dating app matches.
Oh, now it comes back to dating apps.
So it is a very nice measure, and it's a measure economists use. You'll also hear it used a lot in sort of like popular econ. People talk about the Gini coefficient.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to give you a sense of values for this numbers, I'll do it again in income, where we often use it. For Scandinavian countries, the Gini coefficient in income is like 0.25, 0.3. In the U.S., we're a little more unequal. It's like a 0.4, 0.45, depending on the year. The country, when I looked this up in the World Bank data, right now at the highest Gini coefficient, so most unequal, is South Africa, where it's about 0.63.
Mm.
But again, as I mentioned, income is not the only thing we can apply the Gini coefficient to.
Yeah.
It's harder to measure wealth in a lot of countries, but economists have tried to measure wealth inequality. Gini coefficients in that are much bigger.
Higher.
Yeah. But while income and wealth inequality are very serious and important topics, I think we think as a podcast, can I make that statement on behalf of the pod?
You can make that statement.
On behalf of the podcast, I think we're going to take a bold stance. We think income and wealth inequality are very serious and important topics.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep. I agree.
I think we're going to say that on behalf of the pod.
Yeah. We're willing to really put our necks out there for controversial issues.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm very curious what the outcome you're going to say that we will care about is in
dating apps.
Yeah.
I think that's a great point. I'm going to start with likes. So these are like people who sort of like your profile, initiate things.
Okay.
I agree with you that you could think of other outcomes, and we could talk about that in 2 minutes. But we're going to start with likes.
Okay.
And we're going to do that because there is one guy on the internet who tried to calculate a Gini coefficient for dating apps.
Whoa.
And we will share the link. It's a Medium article from like 4 or 5 years ago. The guy who wrote it is anonymous, and he gives like pretty weird vibes, to be honest. So I don't know if we like endorse this guy. But he has a pretty like weird methodology that we can quibble with. But I think the important thing is then a few years later, there was a junior engineer at, I think, Hinge, wrote a blog post, which has since been taken down, where he was like, oh yeah, I use the internal data. This guy's numbers are like pretty close to right for Hinge. The original guy did it on Tinder. So I think we can argue a lot with this guy's methodology, and it's pretty sus, but the numbers end up working out pretty well.
Okay.
So he makes a fake Tinder profile of like a hot man, and then uses that profile to interview girls about like the share of people they're liking on Tinder. He makes some assumptions based on that, and he turns that into a Lorenz curve, basically. There's a lot of like funky stuff he's doing.
Okay,
in that.
So he's just using like survey based, like a weird survey measure of like who are you liking.
Exactly. Okay. And there's like a lot of weird stuff going on, but again, he gets something that apparently looks very similar to what Hinge gets internally.
And is he saying, sorry, is he trying to ask like what percentage of people are you liking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is he doing anything that would let you say like, oh, what if different, like, because if different people were just doing totally, you know, everybody's liking 20%, but we're each liking a different 20%.
Yeah, he is assuming that people have the same literally the same preferences over men.
Okay.
And yes, that would matter. And I think he's open about that. I think this guy is like pretty eyes wide open. And so he is going to get a little bit more inequality than the Hinge internal numbers, but not a crazy amount more.
Okay.
So he constructs a Gini coefficient. And again, just to build intuition for what this would be now in this context, you could take, say you get the likes from 100 randomly selected women, and then you take all of the, maybe they rated 100, they rated 100 men, you put those 100 men in a line, and the one on the left would be the one who got the least likes, the one on the right would be the one who got the most likes.
Yeah.
And you could again just make that curve, which is like the cumulative likes. So if the women, just again, super heteronormative Sorry. they did it, and this guy was a guy, did it with women. But if the women just liked men randomly, had like, you know, totally separate preferences, then there would be, you would get like this flat 45-degree line. If every woman liked every man, you'd also get the 45-degree line. Otherwise, you're going to get this bent curve again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Cassidy.
Yes.
He does this exercise.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up with a Gini coefficient.
Mm-hmm.
I think Gini coefficients are hard to think about in numbers.
Uh-huh.
So I will ask you, do you think it was higher or lower than the U.S. Gini coefficient? So U.S. income inequality. Yeah, the U.S. Income inequality coefficient is about 0.42. Higher or lower?
I feel like I would think that dating apps would be more unequal than the U.S. economy the U.S. income.
That is, in fact, the case. He ends up with a Gini coefficient of about 0.58.
Okay.
So that's
Not as bad as South Africa.
Exactly. Substantially higher than the U.S. income inequality, but not quite as bad as South African income inequality.
It's a crazy comparison.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
His stats imply that the bottom 80% of men, in terms of attractiveness, are competing for the bottom 22% of women in terms of attractiveness. Okay. So then now, a few years later, and this is taken down now, but we'll put up the...
Why was it take it down? Was it take it down for, like...
I think it was probably taken down because it's, like... It was just some engineer being like, yeah, it is. This guy's kind of right. Like, it is pretty unequal.
And Hinge, maybe doesn't want.
But you can just find it on the internet time machine and we'll link it.
Okay.
Okay, so this Hinge engineer said, if you look at the Gini coefficient using their internal data,
yeah.
And he does it for straight men and straight women.
Okay.
For straight men, they found 0.54, so pretty close to that 0.58.
Okay.
Again, much higher than the U.S. would be one of the highest in the world. I think in this blog post they even say, like, that would be, like, eighth highest country in income inequality in the world. Again, maybe why it's taken down. But for straight women,
uh-huh.
It is more like 0.37, so similar to Western Europe.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And so this, I did not know about any of this, but again, multiple friends told me about this. This article sparked a lot of discussion online, both the original one and then mm-hmm. the other one. And there's tons of people, especially a lot of angry young men, who talk about this online. And so now, Cassidy, I'll ask you this may be one of the spiciest questions we've ever done on the show. What do you think explains that those differences in Gini coefficients?
Okay, I have a couple of thoughts.
Okay.
So, I'm gonna try to be tactful here.
yeah. I mean, fundamentally, to review, the question is, why is like inequality so much worse for men on
okay.
dating apps than women?
Two factors I'm thinking about.
Okay.
So, thinking about the story I told you earlier about my friend and the date showing up in a white van in front of her house.
Yeah.
I think that when women are swiping on dating apps, my guess would be that they have just sort of like more fear in their swiping than like I think that they I think that there are reasons that women are probably more conservative in their
swipes
than men. And I think that's like just like basic safety.
Yep.
And I think if they're sort of like not that much to go on in the profile, then I think women would maybe be kind of likely to say like, I'm not going to like, it's not really worth it to like take risks on a situation where I don't know that much about the person from the profile.
Yeah.
And then kind of like, hand in hand with that, if I just kind of think anecdotally about women's dating profiles versus like men's dating profiles, I think that men are maybe on average like a little less like thoughtful or like able to simulate like how is this going to like come across. And I think that most women that are putting out dating app profiles are, like, getting a lot of consults on it. And they're putting out something, like, a pretty cute and polished product that is painting them in the best possible light. Yeah, those things can kind of work together if, like, I suspect that women might just be, like, a bit better on average of, like, putting their best foot forward, yeah, yeah. and that helps. But yeah. then also for, like, to the extent that men maybe aren't always putting their best foot forward, I think that that interacts, like, poorly for them with the fact that, like, yeah. women are going to be cautious.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's definitely evidence on the first thing you said, which is that women do like fewer profiles than men on average, and that contributes to it. The second thing, I also asked some people this week this question of why they think this is, and mm-hmm. the second thing you said also came up a lot, which is people think that women are much better at setting up profiles and appearing presentable. And I'll give one anecdote on that, which is I have a friend, a male friend, who is quite handsome, I think. And at one point he was like, yeah, I'm getting a lot of weird matches on the thing. Like, do you want to look at the profile? And it was with my wife. And we were like, yeah, we'll look at it. And he made some joke where he was like, I'm really interested in. And then he was like, I'm really. So first of all, English is not his first language. So there's also a weird translation thing. But he was like, I'm really interested in, like, young women on, like, floaties and pools. And he's like, it's so funny because, like, every woman has a picture like that on their profile. And first of all, it sounds creepy. Second of all, like, these women, like, do not see any of the other profiles of women, so that joke is just not going to land ever. And so we were like, dude, this is not a good move. Yeah.
That's so bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no.
He turned it around. He's a he's a handsome guy. He's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll take you far in this life.
One additional thing on this, so in economics, people will often say things about what they call, like, equity efficiency trade-offs. And so I think we could spend a lot more time on this in the context of another episode, so I won't say more here. But it's this idea that in some contexts, more equality or more equity could actually make things, like, less efficient. And I think there's a lot of evidence that while that can be true in some contexts, the reverse can be true in other contexts. So more equity can actually lead to more efficiency. But one thing we can think about here is, like, you know, is this inequity really a bad thing? Like, is it, you know, maybe it is the case that, like, you know, everyone wants to have a shot at dating certain people or something. I don't know. I don't know what the sort of normative right or wrong is. I'm not going to take a stance on it because I feel like I will get a lot of people angry.
Yeah. Cool.
Okay. And then one last thing I'll say, which I think is a much more optimistic light. So that in that now removed Hinge blog post, and this gets back to the very first point you made, it is they do that number not for likes but for actual connections and, like, meetups in person.
Yeah.
And there it actually doesn't look so bad. It's still 0.32 for men, which is, like, now approaching Nordic country income inequality.
Uh-huh.
And they don't give the actual number, but they say the curve looks pretty weird and, like, almost flat for women. Suggesting that it's, like, basically sort of close to that 45. So maybe some of that is Hinge's particular model, but at least that makes it seem like actual connections are not so unequal as likes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes. Okay. One final, very short angle, because I know we're very long on time. We've been having too much fun saying our spiciest takes on true love and inequality.
Yeah, because a lot of people, we know a lot of you guys are coming to an economics podcast for advice on love and relationships.
yeah. And now you know, just 37%. 37%. Yeah. one thing I want to briefly touch on that I think is interesting, and I feel like I might get dinged for this in the voting because it's not the essence of dating apps, but I feel like if I can't use the fact that I co-host a podcast to talk about topics I'm interested in, then what am I doing?
Yeah, fair.
And I want to talk about actual economic inequality, and talking about it through another measure that you mentioned at the beginning when we were talking about measures, and that's upward mobility, how likely you are to move up in the income distribution. There's lots of folks, especially at Harvard, studying how to create more upward mobility, but actually one of the key ways that people actually move up in the income distribution, which I think economists generally don't focus on a bunch because it's hard to sort of control, is like who you marry. So marrying rich is marrying into a richer family is a pretty good way to get to move upward.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a couple of econ PhD students at Harvard a few years ago who did actually study this, so these cross-class marriages. And so the people were Benny Goldman and Jamie Gracie, friends of the pot. I don't know. And they wrote a paper called Who Marries Whom. Cassidy, can you maybe give me, like, two-sentence description of what goes on in that paper?
Yeah, yeah. So they document like a few kind of key, a couple key facts where they first just show that people are very unlikely to marry people from different class backgrounds and of different races. And I think like that was not necessarily surprising to me conceptually, but the actual numbers, which I did not write down, were kind of crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the paper is thinking about, like, you know, you might, the reason it's probably not so surprising that you more likely marry people of same income, same race, is just like, who do you spend time around? Like, you have to meet someone in order to marry them. And we kind of know that we spend time in spaces where people are more like us. And so they try to see, like, how much of it's just exposure and then how much of it might be something else.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And then on the crazy stats, like, two of the key stats in the paper are in, like, the first sentence of the paper, which is by class, if you're born in the top – or, sorry, the bottom quartile, so the bottom one-fourth of families by income, the chance that you marry someone in the top one-fourth, if that was random, that would be 25%.
Yep.
Instead, that is 3%. So only 3% of people born in the top or the bottom quartile marry someone from the top quartile.
Yeah, that's nuts. That is so nuts.
And then they also talk a lot about race in the paper. So I feel like this one is also, you know, crazy. Among Black Americans born in the 1980s, only 2% are married to a white spouse. And so, as you mentioned, the paper spends a lot of time discussing what might be driving that. Some of it's exposure. A lot of it is not exposure. And so now I just, to tie it back to dating apps and conclude, I just want to ask you how you think dating apps do or don't affect these trends. And I think there's no, so the punchline is going to be, I don't think there is one answer to it. I've seen research in a few different directions.
Okay. Well, so I guess I would think that what dating apps do, so a couple of things, like to the extent that you think this is about exposure, you might think dating apps should help because you should just be being exposed to a larger set of people. But to the extent that it's not just about exposure, I think you would kind of feel like dating apps might make some of this worse. I would specifically kind of guess that dating apps would make race worse. And that's because I think broadly dating apps kind of like encourage us to focus on like a few key dimensions.
Yeah.
Like when you're swiping, you aren't spending like that much time. There's not even that much information on profiles. And so I feel like it's sort of natural that you sort of come up with some generic rules that you basically use to make your decision. And when there's just like not that much information to attend to, and like one thing that you can definitely see in a dating app is like someone's race, then I would kind of worry that to the extent that already there might be like inequality in people's like willingness to date other races or things, I would think that might be worse in a setting where like that's one of the main things you can observe about them, and you're not seeing like the way they like chat or like their energy or you know.
I think that's exactly the sort of mixed evidence. There's some evidence that relationships get more diverse. There's like a largely theoretical working paper by a couple of economists which argue that online dating will lead to much higher rates of interracial marriage. They show in the time series, so like at the same time dating apps came around, interracial marriages goes up. Super hard to tease out. There's also some survey evidence. So I found like there's an Atlantic article that's like the evidence shows that people are like these relationships are getting more diverse, and if you look at the papers they're looking at, those are pretty clear to say that like we look at relationships that started online and those that didn't start online, and survey a bunch of people, and the ones that started online look more diverse. But they say even in those papers, like those relationships are different in a lot of ways. In particular, they're usually younger people, and younger people are just in more diverse relationships.
Yeah.
So it's not very strong evidence that dating apps are doing something one way or the other.
Okay.
And there's also some evidence. Some other evidence using like different correlation surveys showing that like especially on race, it doesn't seem like things have gotten better or worse. It's about the same.
Okay.
If you take the like results of the paper we just talked about literally, there they say it's mostly not about exposure for race, like you mentioned. And then if that were the case, then it's really going to be like these dating apps aren't going to do much or even push in the other direction because you can, like you said, sort of sort on different characteristics. And to the extent people are just making sort of superficial judgments, and then it can actually make things worse. So I think in the short term, it's going to be tough to know. I mean, I did not find, you can imagine there could be some great natural experiment paper where dating apps are introduced quasi-randomly. I didn't find that paper. And so maybe someone out there will write it. But but it is sort of a tough thing to parse.
If you're writing that paper and you want to be a guest on our podcast, just message us. And
we'll
bring you on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do a follow-up episode and talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to conclude. First, I want to mention, and here I'm just definitely groveling, there is much more economics I didn't even mention. There's matching problems, which we said at the outset of the show. There's the fact that dating apps themselves are a business model and they need to make money. People talk about the dating app paradox, where if you're successful, then people leave your app. There's been a lot written and talked about that. I figured that might be a little bit of a low-hanging fruit. Wanted to do some more fun, interesting econ-y topics. So didn't talk about that. But those are all obviously economics. And then I gave you three very interesting angles. One, I said, I gave you some practical economics advice.
Yep.
About how to do how to navigate dating apps through the optimal stopping problem. I taught you about the secretary problem, 37%. That's a very tangible rule you can take to your life. we talked about inequality, the Gini coefficient, and how that helps us think about quantifying inequality in online dating. And then we talked about the ways that dating apps are maybe affecting or not affecting economic and racial diversity of couples, which is in turn one of the biggest drivers of upward economic mobility.
Yes.
Given all of that,
Cassie,
I'm going to ask you the big question.
Okay.
How economics are dating apps?
Okay. So I think you brought some very good economics to the table.
Okay.
I think that this one is a harder one, because of kind of what we talked about at the beginning with, the secretary problem. It's even though I do think it's right that economic thinking lends some insights on, how you might think about these problems.
Yeah.
I still feel like I really prefer to not think about And, when I think about, I'm getting married in a few months. About my relationship. I don't think I want to think about it in terms of, and how close am I in expectation to the optimal relationship that I could have had I been able to observe the entire dating pool available to me?
Yeah, I didn't think about it when I was preparing the show. And then, you asked me a very simple question I should have thought about, which was just you didn't follow the 37% rule yourself. And I was just like, oh, shit. And then, yeah, I agree. I was like.
And so I think, because I, so I agree there's economics in dating apps, but I think at the end of the day, a lot of the stuff we talked about, I think you still gotta
do vibes.
Still about the heart.
Yeah.
Matters of the heart.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna give this one a 5.
That's fair. And honestly, for our world, I hope you're right. I think think about how much of a bummer it would be if everyone was out there doing the 37% thing and you just didn't know. There's
you didn't
a 1 in 3
if you
chance.
Were in the 37,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a 1 in 3 chance that you have no chance. That also, yeah, I guess that also breaks down if you can't.
I feel like that's really the plot of the stupidest rom com where you have have a man and woman doing the 37%. They're in each other's 37%.
Yeah.
But then they realize later, no, that was the best one. the rule is.
Yeah, you can't go back.
That's
the rules of the game.
But that's all, yes.
Yeah, that's
job,
it.
Job well
go
done.
Vote. Hopefully you vote stronger than Cassidy for me. I still think that's pretty economics-y, all the things. Because I feel like my other two angles were not about optimal decision-making. They're about the greater context.
It's true.
Feel free to vote high if you want to vote high. Okay. Thanks for listening.
We'll see you next time.
Yep. Mark your calendar, December 11th.
And
oh yeah.
Just to put it out there, I think we're gonna take a week off for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So your next episode expect in 3 weeks instead of 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Sorry team. Okay. Thanks. Bye, guys.
Thanks.